Well, thanks for that very generous introduction, Mike. Thanks a lot for arranging this. Thanks to the Chamber for arranging this. I'm really glad to have this opportunity to speak to you all. It's great to be back here in Wisconsin, among other things. I've been to many places in your state as a tourist. I've been to Corny, Cornucopia, Prairie du Chien, Madison. That just names a few of the places. And my main responsibility for coming out here in Wisconsin, at least for my wife, is I have to stop at the North Canuck to get a couple pieces of pie before I go home. I've been to Wisconsin many times. This is my first trip here as the president of the Federal Reserve Bank of Minneapolis, and I'm delighted to be here. One of the parts of my job that I'm really enjoying is this ability to get out into the 9th District and talk to people. It's, I think, always important for the presidents of the Federal Reserve Banks to engage in this kind of public dialogue. But I think it's really important at this moment in history when there's so many questions being raised about the Federal Reserve and its role in the economy. So today what I'm going to do is talk about my economic outlook, then turn to three important issues that are facing the Fed related to that outlook. Before I go on, though, I must say that any views I share today are my own and not necessarily those of the Federal Reserve System. So let me first remind you of the role that I and you play in the making of monetary policy. The Minneapolis Fed is one of 12 regional reserve banks that, along with the Board of Governors in Washington, D.C., make up the Federal Reserve System. Our bank represents, as Mike mentioned, the 9th of the 12 Federal Reserve districts. And our district includes, is really big in terms of area, Montana, the Dakotas, Minnesota, northwestern Wisconsin, and the Upper Peninsula of Michigan. It's less big in terms of population. We're the smallest by population. Every 6 to 8 weeks, the Federal Open Market Committee meets to vote on monetary policy. So the committee officially consists of the Board of Governors of the Federal Reserve System, the President of the New York Fed, and four other presidents of various reserve banks. These other presidents rotate through on an annual basis. So I'll be on the committee as a voter in 2011. Even though only five of the presidents are voting at any time, though, on monetary policy, the other seven, including myself, attend the committee's meetings and participate fully in its deliberations. So in this way, the structure of the FOMC mirrors the federalist structure of our government. Representatives from different regions of the country, the various presidents, have input into FOMC deliberations. And the independent input of the presidents relies critically on information they receive from their districts about local economic performance. Now, some of this is coming from our research staffs. We have great research staffs, and they work really hard to gather this information. But we also obtain it from business leaders like you, members of our board of directors like Mike, as well as members of our advisory councils in agriculture and small business and labor. Keep us attuned to what's happening in the community in real time. I thank them and the former members of those groups that are out there for their hard work. And it's their diligence is what gives the residents of Main Street a voice in monetary policy. So in an FOMC meeting, the 17 attendees each present their current outlook, their current assessment of the state of the economy and its outlook. In the same vein, let me tell you about my own outlook. So GDP growth has been positive each of the past three quarters and was 3.2% in the past quarter. I expect GDP growth to be near 3% again in the current quarter and to average close to 3.5% over the next 2 years. I think we can safely say the recovery is well underway. Now, at the same time, we've had a very deep recession, and my projected recovery does not have the V-shape that we would prefer to see. And my forecast for GDP growth is pushed downwards by uncertainties along several key dimensions. First, the increase in the public debt in the United States may well lead to an increase in future tax rates. These increases will retard investment and dampen GDP growth. Second, as of the first quarter, bank lending continued to decline, even though the overall economy was growing robustly. This decline has many sources, but it is certainly true that all banks are affected by ongoing regulatory uncertainty, and many are affected by ongoing asset quality concerns. Finally, the fiscal and financial situation in Europe may well lead European growth to continue to be restrained over the next year or two. The news from the labor market is, at first glance, confusing. So last Friday, we learned that the economy had created nearly 300,000 jobs last month, in the month of April. But at the same time, the unemployment rate rose in April to 9.9% from 9.7% in March. So this is confusing, because how can both of these things be taking place at the same time? So to understand this, we have to get into the technicalities of how the unemployment rate is actually calculated. So this is done as follows. The government goes out and asks a large group of people each month, are you working? If you're not working, have you looked for work in the past 4 weeks? The total number of people engaged in one of these two activities, working or looking for work, is called the labor force. And the unemployment rate is the fraction of the labor force who don't have a job but are looking for work, who have looked for work in the last 4 weeks. So what happened in April is that the growth rate of the labor force was actually faster than the growth rate of the employed. My own tentative interpretation is that both of these pieces of information, the increase in the number of jobs and the increase in the size of the labor force, actually indicate that the labor market is starting to function better. So we have basically have lots of people coming in to search for jobs that were not searching before. And our eventual goal is to have these extra searchers to be able to find jobs as well. On that score, I have to say that I believe that the recovery will be slower than we would like. I would be surprised if unemployment were to fall below 9% before the end of 2010, or below 8% by the end of 2011. There were many big surprises during the past recession, but I believe that the remarkable increase in labor productivity was one of the most important. The growth in productivity has allowed firms to expand production without commensurate increases in hiring. So I've touched on GDP and I've touched on the labor market. The truly good news in this economy is about inflation. So over the first quarter of 2010, annualized PCE inflation was 1.5%. I expect it to remain at about this level during the rest of this year. We also are interested in inflationary expectations, as I'll talk about in a few moments. And we can get a market-based measure of inflation expectations over the next 5 years using TIPS yields. So TIPS are these inflation-protected bonds issued by the Treasury, and you can compare their yields to the yields of standard Treasury, what we call nominal Treasuries. But if you do that, those expectations of inflation over the next 5 years are also under 2%. So I've basically now sketched for you my view of GDP growth, what's happening in GDP, what's happening in labor markets, what's happening with regards to inflation. And so what would happen at an FOMC meeting, after presenting our views, the participants would then go around, each present their views of what should be done with monetary policy. So I'm not going to go into too much detail on that point in front of you, but what I will talk about is what, as I see, is the main issues confronting us. I think there are three main ones: short-term interest rates, the Fed's large balance sheet, and fiscal uncertainties. Let me talk first about short-term interest rates. The federal funds rate, the key short-term interest rate, which is set by the FOMC, has been at 0 to 25 basis points, set at a range of 0 to 25 basis points for the past 17 months, since December of 08. Now, we can't set interest rates to be negative. So this is unfortunate for me, because this means that question that I like to ask, or well, actually, people like to ask me more, what's going to happen to interest rates, is an even less interesting one, because, well, they can't go negative, so they have to be going up. But what is, so let me talk about what the FOMC has said about interest rates. The committee, this is the FOMC's March statement, contains the following key sentence. The committee will maintain the target range for their federal funds rate at 0 to 1/4% and continues to anticipate that economic conditions, including low rates of resource utilization, that's one, subdued inflation trends, that's two, and stable inflation expectations, those are three factors to keep in mind, are likely to warrant exceptionally low levels of the federal funds rate for an extended period. So that's one sentence. And what do we learn from that sentence? So right now, the unemployment rate is 9.9%, and measured inflation is low. below 2%, as I mentioned last quarter. Inflationary expectations are also low. As we discussed, expected inflation over the next 5 years is also less than 2%. So in its statement, the FOMC is saying, we're keeping interest rates low to keep unemployment from going any higher. We feel safe in doing so because there seems to be little threat of inflation. I think that most, or maybe even all, of the members of the FOMC and the other presidents that aren't voters agree that current conditions necessitate interest rates near zero. However, the sentence goes on to forecast that these kinds of economic conditions are likely to continue for an extended period. There has been some public disagreement among the members of the FOMC and the other presidents about this extended period forecast, and is one reason given by the president of the Federal Reserve Bank of Kansas City for his dissenting from this FOMC statement at the last three meetings. As for my own view, had I been a voter, I would have voted in favor of the FOMC statement in April. I do think that readers of the FOMC statement should pay very careful attention to its explicit conditionality. The statement says the committee will raise interest rates if economic conditions change appropriately, whether that's in 3 weeks, 3 months, or 3 years. So let me turn next, we talked about short-term interest rates, let me turn next to the issue of our balance sheet. The Federal Reserve has over $2.3 trillion of assets. That's over 2.5 times what we owned in September 2008. I should say it because I wasn't part of the Federal Reserve at that point. So over $2 trillion of those assets are in treasuries or in mortgage-backed securities issued by Fannie Mae or Freddie Mac. These mortgage-backed securities are backed by the U.S. government. The Fed faces no credit risk in holding these mortgage-backed securities. However, they're long-term securities, so if they do expose us to interest rate risk. And they also expose us to prepayment risk. That is, if many people suddenly prepaid their mortgages, we would get a bigger coupon payment from those mortgage-backed securities at that point in time. If few people prepay their mortgages, then the coupon is lower. Now, in the January meetings, the FOMC, in its minutes, unanimously expressed support for the proposition that it would like to return to a much smaller all-Treasury portfolio in the long run. So this is a statement about both scale and composition. Why do we want the portfolio to be smaller than it is now? There are many reasons. I'll speak about my own. For my own part, I worry that a large balance sheet, like we're currently maintaining, could trigger inflation. Why do we want to get out of MBSs? Again, there are many reasons for this view, but one is certainly that we don't want to be seen as a long-term prop for the housing sector. Now, what does long-term mean in this? Oh. Many of the mortgage-backed securities that we hold will not mature for 30 years. Now, I talked about people prepaying their mortgages, and prepayments will serve to reduce the size of our portfolio in mortgage-backed securities. But prepayment is a very slow process. What we've estimated in Minneapolis is that even 20 years from now, the Fed is likely to have something like $250 billion of mortgage-backed security holdings if we just waited for prepayment to work. That means if we want to normalize our balance sheet sometime in the next two decades, next 20 years, we will need to sell some of our mortgage-backed security holdings. Now, doing so is challenging. We want to be careful not to cause large jumps in long-term interest rates, and especially not in mortgage rates. But I believe that we can do this as long as we commit to a sufficiently slow pace of sales. I'm optimistic that we can get mortgage-backed securities off our balance sheet by 2020 at the very latest, so in a decade. So I've talked about short-term interest rates and I've talked about our balance sheet. Let me say a few words about fiscal policy and inflation. Now, almost everybody thinks that inflation is the sole responsibility of the Fed, and that's not true. Congress also plays a key role. Over the past 2.5 years, the amount of federal debt in the hands of the private sector has increased by over 50%. This extra debt can be paid off only in one of two ways. First, Congress can cut spending or raise taxes. Second, the Fed can print extra money to pay off the extra obligations, but that would create inflation. So logically, this means that if Congress does not raise taxes or cut spending, the Fed must create inflation. So we rely on Congress to do its job and display fiscal responsibility if we are to be able to do ours. So far, I would say that despite some grumbling in some circles, the public has faith in both Congress and the Fed. As I mentioned earlier, inflationary expectations, as measured by these TIPS yields, remain low. So I've covered three key issues in monetary policy today. I've talked about short-term interest rates, talked about the balance sheet, and I've talked about fiscal policy uncertainties. Let me close by talking about the most recent decision of the FOMC to create temporary swap lines with the Bank of Canada, the Bank of England, the Bank of Japan, the European Central Bank, and the Swiss National Bank. These lines allow these central banks, not private banks, to borrow dollars from the Fed. The loans are short-term, under 3 months, and require the borrower to repay us in dollars. So we give them dollars, they'll repay us in dollars. The loans are secured because a borrower who borrows $10,000 gives us $10,000 worth of their home currency to hold as collateral. So if the European Central Bank were to borrow dollars from us, they'd give us an equivalent amount of euros to hold as collateral. So I'm happy to talk about the economics of these arrangements, but they're pretty basic and compelling. We open these lines to allow the central banks, especially the European ones, to ease funding pressure in dollar interbank lending markets. We didn't do so out of any special love for Europe. We're American policymakers. We make decisions to keep the American economy strong. But the liquidity problems in European markets were showing signs of creating dangerous illiquidity problems in our own country's financial markets. We knew that the swap lines would be a useful step in heading off that process. So I think that the decision about swap lines is more interesting for an institutional reason than for an economic one. There has been a huge demand from the public and its elected representatives for more Fed transparency. I guess there's some people outside also who are asking for that. Our communication around the swap lines has been highly responsive to this demand. On Tuesday, we released the exact contracts, the legal contracts that are involved in the arrangements. The exact loan amounts on a bank-by-bank basis, central bank-by-central bank basis, will be announced on a weekly basis. I am happy to see this. It is often said, and it is true, that the Fed of 2010 is much more transparent than the Fed of 1980. Nonetheless, I believe that we should continue to do more in this dimension. It is absolutely critical to the health of the country that the Fed remains independent of short-term political pressures. But we do not need to be opaque to be independent. Thank you for your attention, and I'm happy to take questions.